Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Thank you all for joining us. Today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org, if you would like to share it with any colleagues or classmates who are unable to join us. We are delighted to have James Lindsay with us to discuss how foreign policy is playing out in the U.S. presidential election. Dr. Lindsay is CFR's Senior Vice President, Director of Studies, and the Maurice R. Greenberg Chair. Prior to returning to CFR in 2009, he was the inaugural director of the University of Texas at Austin's Robert Strauss Center for International Security and Law. He previously served as deputy director and senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution. He was a professor of political science at the University of Iowa and director for global issues and multilateral affairs at the National Security Council. He is the author of the CFR blog, The Water's Edge, which you can find on our website, and he's written numerous books on American foreign policy and international relations. Thank you very much, Jim, for being with us today. I can think of no one better to talk about how foreign policy is playing out in this election, particularly in light of Romney's speech this past Monday. And if we have time, it would be great if you could talk about the challenges facing the next president, regardless of who may win this election.
Okay, thank you, Rena. Thank you for the overly kind introduction, and hello to all the people who have joined us online. I will attempt to tackle the two sets of questions Rena has laid out. First, what role is foreign policy playing in the election, and then talk briefly about what are the challenges awaiting whoever is sworn in on January 20th, 2013. And obviously, during the question and answer session, people want to talk about the election or specific issues, campaign tactics. We can get into all of that. Let me begin first with the question of foreign policy's role in the election. I guess I would describe it this way, that election 2012 is like most American presidential elections in that foreign policy is largely a secondary issue in the campaign. And you can tell it in a variety of ways. Pollsters are fond of going out and asking the so-called most important question. And that is, you ask people in a survey, what do you consider the most important problem or challenge facing the country to be? And when you look at those sort of polls, what you discover is that only about 5% or 1 in 20 Americans name anything that could be labeled a foreign policy, national security, or defense issue. And when people are asked, what are you worried about, what do you want the government to do, their answers are predominantly about domestic issues, specifically things like the economy, jobs, and health care, leading the list. Another way pollsters go out and try to get a sense of what's leading people to vote the way they do is to ask a question along the following line, and that is name a domestic issue or a foreign policy issue driving your decision how to vote, or put this way, how big an influence is foreign policy in your decision to vote? And when we look at those sort of questions, what we discover is that somewhere on the order of 40 to 50% of people mention something about foreign policy. Yeah, I'm figuring that into my vote. But those numbers are 20 to 25 percentage points lower than when you ask them, how important is the economy to your vote, and things like that. So it's pretty clear that the public is not focused first and foremost on foreign policy. And the law of democratic politics is that politicians gravitate toward issues that the public cares about. So it makes sense that politicians, candidates for office, spend a lot of time talking about domestic issues, the tax code, health care, things like that, because that's first and foremost what the public is worried about. But we have to be careful here to say that foreign policy is not the driving issue in the campaign 2012 is not to say that it's irrelevant to the campaign or that it's not being discussed at all. Rena quite rightly pointed out that Governor Romney chose to spend some time on Monday giving a major address on foreign policy. So obviously he sees it as have some importance in his role. And here there are a couple of things to flag. First off is that this is likely to be a very tight election. We can sort of follow all the different tracking polls, but it's clear that we have what they like to say in campaign parlance is a horse race. And so in a horse race, even issues that don't matter to the broader public can be decisive with some constituencies. And again, if you think about the American presidential election, it's not one national election. It's really 50 state-by-state elections. Now, about 40 to 44 of those states, we already know the outcome. I can guarantee that California will vote Democratic. I can also guarantee that Texas will go Republican. But you have in the other states, clearly a good shot of, or both the candidates see a good shot of winning. So in that case, what happens is that candidates are looking for issues that might move certain elements of the public. So again, if the Middle East is important to you, or you're worried about Cuba, or you're worried about Europe or China, candidates speaking to you may be sufficient to move you from the undecided column to the pro-Romney or pro-Obama column, and that can win you a vote. And again, close races, candidates are looking to win votes wherever they can. The second thing is that it's pretty clear that Governor Romney has decided that speaking about foreign policy is a potential way for him to undermine the claims of President Obama's leadership and to tie it into a larger argument the governor has been making since the campaign has begun, that President Obama is a man who is overwhelmed by the events of the moment. And obviously, Governor Romney came out hitting very hard in the early hours of the crisis in Libya, in Cairo. We had protests at the embassy, the killing of the American ambassador at the consulate in Benghazi. Now, he was initially criticized by a number of people, including Republicans, for having jumped the gun and had a rush to judgment on Libya. But it seems pretty clear that the Romney campaign has decided that this is a fruitful line of attack against the president because it allows them to, again, make the argument that President Obama is being shaped by events and not shaping
policy in the 2012 election.
And what has happened, obviously, is that the administration's handling of the results of Libya, first suggesting there was no terrorist connection, then walking that claim back, has allowed the Romney critique to gain momentum, in part because they can say, look, see what we're telling you, this is a president who's not up for the moment. So I would expect foreign policy to continue, but again, it's not likely to dominate the future debates. We're actually going to have a debate focused solely on foreign policy on the 22nd, and so the two candidates will have an opportunity to go back and forth on the merits of their approach to foreign policy. But again, I think if you look at the presidential debate between now and then, the one that's going to be held at Hofstra University next week in the town hall format, I would expect that you will see the questions from the audience to be largely about domestic issues. Now, as far as what the issues are going to be on the agenda of the president who takes office next January, I would divide it up in the following way. There's one really big challenge. Number two, there are a series of immediate tests. And third, there are some big problems on the horizon. And let me sort of begin with the first issue, the big challenge. And it's actually not about foreign policy per se. It's about the overall fiscal health of the United States. Now, right now, if everything remains as is. The U.S. government is headed to go over what has been dubbed the fiscal cliff. At the end of the year, the government is going to, if laws not change, tax cuts enacted by George W. Bush will expire. A series of across-the-board budget cuts mandated by a budget deal struck last summer as we tried to resolve the issue of national debt ceiling will go into place. A reduction in the payroll tax, Social Security, is going to elapse. Long-term unemployment benefit legislation is going to elapse. All of these things taken together will actually work to reduce the size of the $1 trillion plus deficit the U.S. government is running, but it will reduce the deficit at a significant cost in the following sense. Economists say that if all of these things happen, that it will put tremendous, we call, contractionary pressure on the economy. That is, taxes are going to go up, government spending is going to go down, and overall U.S. gross domestic product could fall by 2, 3, 4, 5 percentage points. That means a lot of people out of work. So a big challenge is for the government to come to some agreement about how to avoid the fiscal cliff and not just find a temporary solution that kicks the issue down the road 3 months or 6 months, but a longer-term plan for putting the U.S. Budget on a sustainable footing. The reason I cite that is crucial to thinking about foreign policy because the economy sort of forms the bedrock, the foundation of America's ability to exercise power overseas. Just sort of think about it simply. If the budget cannot be put into balance, then eventually it's going to be very hard to run, let's say, a very large defense budget. That's going to mean significant cuts in military spending. That's going to mean significant cuts in manpower. That's going to mean significant cuts in weaponry and what have you. Now, moving beyond the big challenge, the immediate foreign policy tests are really three. First question is Iran, and that is, are we able to coerce the Iranians into suspending their nuclear program? If we're not able to do that, are we prepared to shift to a policy of containment, that is, learning to live with Iranian nuclear weapon, or are we going to attack? Second big issue is Afghanistan. The situation there has deteriorated noticeably over the last year. There's been a rise of so-called green-on-blue attacks, that is, Afghans attacking U.S. and Western soldiers, which has really sort of derailed the policy of building an indigenous Afghan military establishment. So the question is, are we committed to the 2014 handover, or are we going to have some different kind of policy? The third big issue, or immediate test, excuse me, is Syria. The violence there continues. We're now probably over 20,000 deaths, and there's a real question whether the United States can continues to stand on the sidelines or it intervenes. This may be one of those issues where you will regret it if you do and be sorry if you don't. And as far as the big questions or challenges on the horizon, the number one, China, which is obviously an emerging power and will change the balance of power in East Asia and perhaps more broadly around the world. And the question is, how should the United States prepare, react to that development? Number two, Pakistan, which has a growing nuclear arsenal, but very real threats to the stability of the government at Islamabad. How does the United States respond to that? And finally, the broader issue of climate change, which has the potential, obviously, over the longer run, to change climate windfall patterns, food production, which could have significant ramifications for both economics and national security. In all, it's a daunting agenda for any president, which is why I think all of our sympathies and support should go to whomever wins on November 6th, because he is going to need it. And I'll stop there.
Thanks, Jim. That was a terrific overview and analysis of what will be on the president's plate. Lindsay, let's open up to questions from the students.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key, followed by the 1 key on your telephone keypad now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, press star 2. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question. Our first question comes from Columbia Law School from Professor Maravodis.
Thank you for your talk. My question relates to Iran and whether when you say it's suspending the nuclear program, do we mean complete suspension, or is the possibility of, you know, 3.5% enrichment is an acceptable solution for the United States? And how do you see the differences between the candidates in regards to Iran?
Superb question. A little bit of background, perhaps for the other listeners on the phone call. The process of, let me step back, the sort of choke point, the long pole in the tent for building a nuclear weapon is having the appropriate fissile material. That's the hard thing to do. And as a result, what you have to do is take ordinary uranium and enrich it over a period of time, and you have to generally get up to what they call highly enriched uranium, which takes some doing. And so the question is, as the professor asked, is it possible that the United States could live with lower levels of uranium enrichment? The answer to that is almost certainly yes, but it's going to depend upon what the verification regime or schedule is going to be. And this begins to get very technical, and it gets into questions of your confidence that the Iranians abide by the verification regime, that you have the ability to monitor what's going on even if the Iranians try to misrepresent or hinder you. And those get in a series of very technical questions. And obviously for the United States, whether it's an Obama administration or a Romney administration, you're going to be very, very concerned about your ability to make sure any deal you strike is going to be one that can be enforced. Because obviously you want to avoid a situation where you think you've solved the problem, but the Iranians have a way to go forward with their program clandestinely, and then all of a sudden have a breakout down the road. So that's likely. It's clearly a topic of conversation when Iranian and Western so-called P5 plus one negotiators have gotten together. P5 referring to the five permanent members of the United Nations plus Germany. Now, in terms of the differences between Iran and, actually between Governor Romney and President Obama on how they would handle Iran, I think the answer to that really lies in the eye of the beholder. In essence, both candidates, both the president and Governor Romney, have said they are not ruling out a military option, but that remains very much a possibility, and both of them endorse tougher sanctions. And President Obama most certainly will say, I was able to get an unprecedented sanction regime on Iran because I work with our allies, and Governor Romney argues that the sanctions aren't tough enough and the president should push for more. And he only pushed for the ones he did get because he was under pressure from congressional Republicans. So there's a back and forth about this. The great unknown for any voter is which of the two candidates is more likely to use military force. We really don't know. Second question related to it is, would using military force to disrupt the Iranian nuclear program be a wise strategy? Now, on the first point again, Governor Romney has never said that he intends to use military force against Iran. He may be read as having implied that he would, but he hasn't committed himself to it. In some interviews, he's been very clear to make sure that there are a number of questions he would have to see answered before he can make any decision. In terms of the actual carrying out an attack, there's some dispute among people as to how effective an attack would be. That is, how long would it stop the program for? The numbers commonly tossed about are 1 to 3 years, assuming the attack went well. And that's why you often hear people talk about the metaphor of mowing the lawn, that if you were to attack, because it wouldn't end the program, they could, the Iranians could reconstitute, you'd have to come back in a year or two or three and do the whole thing over again. And here's where you get experts arguing, disagreeing about the political sustainability of such an approach, how the Iranians would react, what would be the reaction domestically in Iran, would the people of Iran repudiate the government for bringing this attack upon them, would they rally around the government, so on and so forth. But it's likely to continue to be a subject of heated debate.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Boston College.
Hi. It's clearly important that the United States has a strong working relationship with China, but it's also clear that it's popular to back China on the campaign trail. So how do the candidates thread this needle? How do they talk about China without undermining either future U.S.-China cooperation or their own candidacies?
It's an excellent question, and it brings to mind recent comments by former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, in which he said he found the comments of both candidates on China to be deplorable. Obviously, the Secretary Kissinger has a long interest in U.S.-China relations, having helped pioneer the opening to China when he was part of the Nixon administration, serving as National Security Advisor back in the late 60s, early 1970s. And I think the questioner points to the temptation in American politics on the campaign trail, which is to beat up on China for a variety of shortcomings because it plays well politically. But obviously, once you go from being candidate to president, you have to live with the consequences of those statements. And in this sense, the U.S. relationship with China is fundamentally different than the U.S. relationship with its last great rival, the Soviet Union. The United States and the Soviet Union had little economic interconnection. They were, in some sense, two totally hermetically sealed, at least toward each other, power blocks. In the case of the United States and China, you actually have this symbiotic relationship, leading some analysts talk about Chimerica, where China exports large amounts of goods to the United States, and then invests a lot of the proceeds of those trades in buying American Treasury notes, allowing the United States to run a very large deficit. So the two are in a very interconnected relationship, which is really emblematic in many ways of the globalized world we find ourselves in. And so this is why Governor Romney, who has talked about how he is going to go after China for being a currency manipulator, the argument being that China artificially depresses the value of its currency, and that makes the prices of its goods artificially low, giving it an advantage to sell into the American market, that he's going to go after China, enforce them to revalue, increase the value of the Chinese currency. And that certainly plays well in a lot of states, particularly states with manufacturing, large manufacturing sectors that have been really hurt over the last decade or so against Chinese and competition from other countries as well. The problem, with that, as many will point out, is that China has many ways to punish the United States in return. They can play tit for tat. If we wish to punish them on currency, they could do a whole bunch of things, from making it harder for American firms to invest in China, to choosing to buy, let's say, planes from Europe rather than from Boeing in the United States, to changing their patterns of investment so they're no longer buying the bonds and notes that make it possible for the U.S. government to run a significant fiscal deficit. So in that sort of relationship where if you try to hurt me, I can hurt you just as much or more, it becomes very difficult to figure out how to act. And to some extent, there's an element of jockeying going on. You're hoping partly by talking tough that you can get the other guy to concede first. One final thing to keep in mind, and this is what I think maybe the big question of the 21st century, and that is, where is China headed? What is China going to become? And this is probably a question that, even the Chinese don't have an answer to. We don't know whether China is going to become a major power that ends up working well with other great powers, whether it's going to be a great power that seeks to impose its will on East Asia, or more broadly, and impose a very different set of values or rules in the international system. So in some sense, that's the big question. Will China be an American partner or an American foe? And the related question being, to what extent does American behavior encourage, increase the chances of one outcome versus the other? Really tough questions that experts in this field argue about all the time.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the United States Military Academy.
Sir, Governor Romney has expressed that he believes Russia to be America's greatest geopolitical rival going forward. So my question is, first of all, do you think that this claim is at all substantiated? And secondly, how do you see this opinion by Governor Romney affecting the election?
Well, let me take the second question first. I think it's the easiest to answer. It's hard to see how Governor Romney's position on Russia, whether you like it or don't like it, is going to have much impact on the election. It's simply, even among foreign policy issues, the public is worried about Russia's not near the top of the list. So I don't see it as an issue that reverberates or resonates in electoral terms. On the specific question of calling Russia America's number one geopolitical foe, the governor has certainly caught a lot of criticism for saying this, and certainly some people have argued that the U.S. relationship with Russia is quite different than the U.S. relationship with the Soviet Union. And indeed, that's sort of one of the interesting things, is that in terms of U.S.-Russian relations, a lot of the conversation tends to focus on a specific issue, that is missile defense. And indeed, Governor Romney made a reference to it in a speech on Monday. That in essence, he's not going to let what Vladimir Putin thinks affect what he's going to do on missile defense. This is a longstanding critique many Republicans have of the Obama administration, that its decision to change military missile defense architectures back in 2009 was driven by a desire to placate the Russians. But what is sort of often left out of the conversation is that, again, our relationship with Russia's much different than it used to be. The United States actually needs Russia on a number of things, most notably needs Russia on when it comes to Afghanistan. One of the little-known sort of policies that has been critical for U.S. policy in Afghanistan has been the opening of what's called the Northern Distribution Network, that is the ability to get materiel to U.S. troops in Afghanistan by going through Central Asia. Look at a map, you immediately discover that Afghanistan is landlocked. And either you get supplies through Pakistan or you come down through the Northern Distribution Network, since we're not going to run weapons through Iran, given our relations with the government in Tehran. And one of the problems with relying solely on Pakistan to have access to Afghanistan is that the Pakistanis would have the ability to shut down, in fact, have on occasion shut down shipments going across the border. So one of the things the Obama administration started out early on was to work with the Russians, who have tremendous influence in Central Asia, to be able to open up this northern distribution network. Now, I say all this just to suggest that the following, and that is candidates on the campaign trail often say things that they're not going to be able to follow through on once they get into the White House. And I think on issues dealing with Russia, it would be very clear for a Romney administration that their dealings in Moscow are not a one-way street, that there are things that we want from Russia that the Russians don't have to give us. And in that case, it becomes a call for the president to decide how he wants to trade things off. And indeed, you know, one of the, there's a fundamental difference between campaigning and governing. When you campaign, you promise. And this is true of Republicans or Democrats. This is not a partisan observation. When you become president, you have to choose. And you discover constraints and trade-offs. On the campaign trail, you can wish away complexity. When you're in the White House, you have to handle complexity. And I'm reminded of Bill Clinton back in 1992, who ran pretty hard on the so-called butchers of Beijing in arguing that the incumbent president, George H.W. Bush, had been too friendly to the Chinese. And he, Bill Clinton, was going to resist things like permanent normal trading relations with China. He became president and discovered that for both economic and security reasons, the positions he had staked out in the campaign trail were unsustainable.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the American University of Sharjah.
Hello. I just want to know, because Romney has not specified what his foreign policy is going to actually entail, many actually assume that it's going to closely resemble Obama. So how do you think that Romney's foreign policy is going to be different from Obama's?
Okay. That's an excellent question, and it's virtually impossible to answer in a precise way for two reasons. One, what candidates say in the campaign trail may or may not be a good indicator of what they do in office. But the second thing is that really answering the question requires some standard of judgment or some perspective. In the sense that if you are, let me just give you an analogy. Whether a picture on a TV screen, what it looks like, depends on how close you are to the screen itself. When you have your nose pressed up against the television screen, it's hard to make out what's there. And I say this because when you look at President Obama and Governor Romney, they are on one level fairly close. Let me just take you back a year here in the political life of the United States. In the summer of 2011, numerous newspapers were writing articles about the resurgence of isolationism or non-interventionism in the Republican Party. And people pointed to the support that Ron Paul, a Republican presidential candidate, enjoyed and argued that isolationism was gripping the Republican Party. Well, Ron Paul didn't win the Republican nomination. Mitt Romney did. Mitt Romney is not Ron Paul. He's an internationalist. He favors active American involvement in the world, argues for American leadership. So in that sense, Mitt Romney is a lot closer to Barack Obama than he is to Ron Paul. There is a similarity. Now, do they agree on all issues? No. And indeed, I mean, there are some issues where they, at least on the campaign trail, appear to be different. I would suspect that Governor Romney would have better relations with Israel, or at least the current Israeli government. I would imagine that Governor Romney would try try different approaches to foreign policy. He said as much as addressed the Clinton Global Initiative last month. I would imagine that a President Romney would at least talk tougher in dealing with the Russians. Interesting question would be, you know, how different would President Romney be in dealing with Iran? It's hard to say because the nature of the challenge will be different 4, 5, 6 months than it is today. The general sense is that the United States has not reached sort of its moment of decision in Iran. So we don't necessarily know, you know, what a President Obama or a President Romney would do when that event happens and whether they would have been different. The one question I think that sort of bubbles up where people ask, is there going to be a difference, is on Syria. In the speech that Governor Romney gave on Monday at the Virginia Military Institute, he said that he was in favor of working with our allies to provide weapons to people in Syria who share our values, to help them overthrow the government of Bashar al-Assad. And, you know, I think whether that's a significant innovation on his part lies in the eye of the beholder. Some people have looked at that statement and said, aha, where the Obama administration has been reluctant to arm the rebels, the President Romney would be eager to arm them. Others have looked and said, that's a very carefully constructed statement that's designed to allow you to think that a President Romney would do this, but doesn't obligate the President, a President Romney, to do it because he never specified what weapons, didn't talk about whether our friends are sufficient in number to be able to make a difference and what have you. So again, you can go back and forth about a lot of these issues. What I do think will be different about the foreign policy of a President Romney versus a President Obama will be on the rhetorical or tonal level. I do think you will have in a President Romney much more talk about American exceptionalism and America's willingness to lead. And again, if you go back and look at the BMI speech, Governor Romney has argued that the world is hungering for American leadership, and it would be an empirical proposition should he become president, whether that is in fact the case.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the Ohio State University.
Hi, good afternoon. If you had to predict an October surprise, where in the world do you think that would happen? Do you think that would be with Iran or Syria? And do you think that it would have the desired effect if it were to happen?
I think the first thing I'm required to say is go blue. I apologize. The question you ask about an October surprise is that, by definition, it catches you unaware. So, I can think of lots of surprises, but I think the biggest one, let me step back, the biggest issue is not the event itself, but how the administration reacts to an event. And I think what happened in Libya is quite telling. Obviously, it was terrible what happened in Benghazi. But I think one of the reasons why Governor Romney's criticisms gained traction is because the administration appears not to be in control of or in charge of what's happening there, and the changing story clearly plays into the charge by the Romney campaign that the Obama administration is, in some sense, not ready for prime time or not up to the demands of the moment. Now, if you look at the potential of an Israeli attack in Iran, that's certainly possible, and it's really hard to say how that would play out. It would depend upon a lot of things. Does the United States try to, or does the Obama administration try to dissuade the Israelis from conducting the attack? Is the attack successful or not? What kind of collateral damage does it have? So a lot of particulars that could really sort of shape the course. Now, I know for a number of years, people have talked about the potential for October surprises, but for the most part, they seem not to come about. And I should just conclude for people who don't go to Ohio State that my reference to Go Blue is a friendly reminder of the friendly rivalry between my alma mater, the University of Michigan, and the Buckeyes of Ohio State.
Thank you, Jim, for that clarification. Next question.
Thank you again, ladies and gentlemen. If you'd like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the 1 key on your telephone keypad. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question. Our next question comes from Penn State University.
Yeah, Jim, seems to me that you've left out one significant difference between the two candidates on the question of Iran's nuclear program. Romney has flip-flopped a bit, but basically seems to be saying that he would prevent Iran from gaining the capability to make a nuclear weapon. Obama has said he would prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, and the difference between capability and actual possession is vast, especially since if you define capability as being able to enrich uranium, the Iranians already have that capability. So given that and the fact that Romney has said repeatedly that there will be no daylight between him and his administration in Israel, isn't he in effect saying he has the right to declare war on Iran whenever he wants, since they already have the capability? And secondly, isn't he saying that Netanyahu will determine when that war starts, because he's not going to have any differences with Mr. Netanyahu?
An excellent question, really hard to answer. I don't think I would draw that series of inferences from the facts as we currently see them. I mean, I think there's an obvious issue here which complicates any talk about Iran, which you put your finger on, Dennis, which is that what does it mean for Iran to go nuclear? What exactly is the red line? And there clearly is a difference between the Obama administration and Prime Minister Netanyahu as to where exactly that red line is. Is it having a capability? Is it having a weapon? Is it testing a weapon? There are various places you could imagine drawing a line. But even, again, talking about having the capability, as your question pointed out, it's not at all clear how you know or what constitutes having the capability to build a weapon. And, again, I'm always reluctant, based on what candidates say on the campaign trail, to draw a straight line to a specific policy choice. I mean, I could just easily imagine that if there is a President Romney, that the nature of the relationship with Prime Minister Netanyahu changes, and perhaps President Romney is not necessarily drawn in the direction that the Prime Minister of Israel wants him to go, but could be drawn exactly the opposite direction, where President Romney persuades the Prime Minister of Israel that he will take care of his interests. So there's a lot of complicating factors, and again, I know when you're on the campaign trail, we always try to sort of read the tea leaves, because that's the business we're in, but I would caution against drawing too hard and fast conclusions. And again, there was a wonderful interview that Governor Romney gave, I think last November, to the Washington Examiner, which is a fairly conservative paper here in Washington, D.C. And he was asked a question by the editorial board about his policy on. It was very, very interesting, very telling. He went through a long list of questions that he would have to ask before he decided to ask. And it was a very serious, sensible set of questions. Indeed, you might have thought it was written by a fellow at any one of a number of think tanks here in Washington, D.C. So I guess I'm a little bit in that it could happen the way you lay it out, but I wouldn't necessarily assume it would.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from St. John's College.
With regards to possible U.S. intervention in Syria, I'm just wondering what the wider implications would be with our situation with Iran.
Wow. Super question. And to some degree, it depends upon what kind of intervention and how things go. I think, one of the arguments for the United States to intervene, typically through proxies, in Syria is that if the government of Bashar al-Assad is ousted, that you will deprive the government in Tehran of its one major ally, and that you could fundamentally change the dynamics in the basically Eastern Mediterranean, really sort of change what's happening in Lebanon, what's happening in Syria. And this could be sort of a major geopolitical game changer. And there's probably a lot to be said for that argument. The challenge, however, is how could you, or the issue really is, would we like what comes after the Assad government? And what many people worry about is that if the Assad government goes, that what you won't get, won't necessarily get, is a stable, pro-Western, peaceful, orderly country. But that you could end up with a chaotic situation in which either no one controls Syria, or there's a fight for Syria, or Syria breaks up. And you know, this is sort of the challenge for policymakers as they evaluate whether the United States should intervene in Syria or not, or how they should intervene in Syria, is making judgments about what you think are the likely consequences of the decisions you make. And so in that sense, it's simply not a decision of whether you want the government of Bashar al-Assad to go, but what you assess the likelihood or probability that you could end up with a successor government that you like more. And I think in this sense, if you think of Libya, it's sobering on that score. The United States, obviously, along with its Western allies, made it possible for Libyans to overthrow Colonel Gaddafi. But the fact is that Libya is having a great deal of difficulty putting together a stable, effective government, and some of the recent signs there are troubling. Plus, there's a spillover from Libya into Mali, which is equally troubling, creating sort of more so-called ungoverned spaces where Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda-like elements can operate. And so the question you have in dealing with Syria is, you know, which is worse, ending up with a continued civil war or having the Assad government go and having a political situation which could be quite chaotic and could easily spill across borders. And how could you prevent that? And this is an issue that experts go back and forth on because it's maybe inherently unknowable ahead of time. So a lot will depend upon the Syrians themselves, the choices they make, the quality of their leadership, and what have you.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the University of Puget Sound.
Hi. So Afghanistan has been one of President Obama's more talked about foreign policy projects, but Green and Blue attacks seem to have undermined these a little bit in his goals there. Do you think it's likely that we'll see a policy change by either candidates that will be a little more strict in Afghanistan, or do you think it's more likely that we'll see something where the president decides to pull out more troops?
Well, current policy is to draw down U.S. troops by 2014. Some residual force would remain in Afghanistan. Governor Romney has said on the campaign trail that he is in favor of the idea of a timeline, a handover of major security duties to the Afghans themselves. I mean, the real question is whether that's going to be sustainable. And Governor Romney clearly hedged his position in the speech at VMI, which he said when he gets there, should he become president, he will sit down with the best military commanders and discuss where things stand and make decisions based on that. So he has not committed himself to sort of automatically going forward with a drawdown, but he hasn't ruled it out. And you can either judge that to be his fudging the issue or his making a reasonable decision that he doesn't want to foreclose his options until he has a better handle on the situation. And indeed, one of the challenges in evaluating candidates is that the situation they will face in office could be very different than the situation that they're currently facing. The security situation in Afghanistan clearly deteriorates. It could conceivably deteriorate even more. In what sort of choices that will be made on that score. And then it gets embedded in a broader set of discussions about what's going to happen to defense spending, does you avoid the sequester, and so on and so forth. So there are a lot of factors that could influence how this is going. What is clear is that U.S. ambition in Afghanistan have been downscaled dramatically over the last decade, and the hopes of having this vibrant pro-Western democracy that many people had in the early 2000s has given way to just simply hoping to stave off a Taliban takeover and the horrific bloodletting that almost certainly would follow after that.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Richard Stockton College.
Hi. The 1997 Kyoto Agreement expires this year. Do you feel either candidate would take an initiative or leading role in developing a new and perhaps stronger agreement?
Based on what they have said on the campaign trail, the answer to that is no. I mean, it's very clear that climate change activities or action aren't popular with the American public, and many Americans believe that climate change is either a hoax or is greatly exaggerated or will be something that we can deal with when it happens. As you know, there are many people in the scientific community who would disagree with that, but that's the reality. I mean, Governor Romney has said that he believes that climate change is happening. He accepts that human beings may have contributed to it, but he thinks it's too preliminary to commit vast amounts of money in action to taking any step. President Obama had talked a lot about climate change when he was a candidate, but as president, his efforts on climate change have lagged, and recognizing that the chances of getting major climate change legislation through the current U.S. Congress is simply not going to happen. And what is interesting to note is, at least in the United States, emissions in the United States have dropped considerably for a couple of reasons, partly because of the slowdown in economic production due to the recession, but also because of the very remarkable, very swift changeover in fuel sources from coal to the burning of more and more natural gas, much of which has come through this process known as hydraulic fracturing or fracking, whereby natural gas trapped in shale deposits is fractured, broken open, and extracted. And I think one of the things to keep an eye on is what happens with the so-called boom in natural gas here in the United States and basically parts of Pennsylvania, Ohio, and elsewhere in the country where there are large deposits of shale gas. And my colleague, Michael Levy, who you can find on CFR.org, tracks a lot of these issues in great detail. And it really does have the potential to be a game changer in a number of ways, not just on the climate change front, but also geopolitically. The consequences that will look to happen to the oil and also the gas markets as new and non-traditional sources of oil and gas come online. Doesn't mean it will happen, but there's certainly a lot of interesting things happening in that space that could change some of the market and some of the political dynamics that we've grown accustomed to. Again, that's Michael Levy, L-E-V-I.
And he also authors a blog on CFR.org.
Yeah.
Next question, please.
The next question comes from Oberlin College. In Oberlin College, be sure your line isn't on mute.
Speaking out against human rights abuses has often been a component of U.S. foreign policy. Is there a difference between Romney and Obama on how they approach human rights abuses?
Well, it's hard for me to say. I'm not aware of Governor Romney as having spoken specifically on this issue. And it's also hard to answer in part because what it means to stand up for human rights abuses can be difficult to pin down. I would imagine that a surrogate for Governor Romney would argue that his policy of be willing to arm Syrian rebels is an example of his being far more willing than President Obama to take steps to end human rights abuse, in this case by helping overthrow a government that is inflicting him. Obviously, you know, Republicans in general have been more critical of multinational institutions, things like the International Criminal Court, than Democrats have. But in practice, Republican presidents have been able to work with the ICC in other organizations. So, again, it's sort of hard to answer. Almost certainly on some specific issue, a Romney administration would handle an issue differently than an Obama administration would, but I'm not so sure I would draw the same kind of distinction on a larger, more macro level.
I think we can sneak in one more question.
Our final question will come from St. Edward's University.
Are you there?
Again, St. Edward's University, please be sure your line is on mute.
Oh, sorry about that. Do you believe that Obama's policies as far as foreign relations have hurt our U.S. relations more than helped them? And what changes would you suggest that he make to his current policy?
Well, you know, it's always hard to rate a president on foreign policy because it's in the nature of the challenge that you're going to have some successes and some failures. I mean, I think we naturally have this tendency, we expect a president's ability on foreign policy to sort of be like, oh, I don't know, shooting free throws. Should be able to knock them down one after the other. If you're competent, you'll get problems fixed. I think it's more like a baseball player. You think of even sort of the best baseball hitters making out probably six or seven times they go to the plate. And in part because if you look at the challenges that currently face the United States, they are really hard to solve. And it's always the case that the challenger will get up and say, you didn't solve X, Y, and Z. But sort of think about it. Think about North Korea. Think about Iran. They're both issues that have been on America's foreign policy plate since, in the case of Iran, all the way back to Jimmy Carter. In the case of North Korea, certainly to the first Bush presidency. And we haven't been able to sort of lick or resolve these problems. And so, I mean, where I would give President Obama credit, and I think we rightfully point to this, is the obvious one with the killing of Osama bin Laden. But also, the administration did a remarkably good job of being able to build an international coalition to put sanctions on Iran. And it's important to understand that in a world in which the United States is a major economic power, but not the only economic power, that the United States can unilaterally decide to sanction Iran, but unless it can bring others on board, those sanctions aren't likely to have any impact. And it's clear that the economic sanctions that have been imposed over the last several years have had considerable impact. The Iranian currency last week fell about 40%. So these sanctions are biting. Will they be sufficient to compel the Iranians to change their policy in ways that the West or the United States find acceptable? Perhaps not. But it is nonetheless, I think you have to say that the president has had some success on that score. But has the president solved all the problems that he was hoping to solve back when he was on the campaign trail in 2008? Nope, but I'm not aware of any president who does.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you all for your questions, and thank you, Jim, for this hour with us. It was a terrific call, and we appreciate your insights on both the election and the foreign policy challenges. Just as a reminder to all of you, Jim Lindsay, has a blog on our website. It's called The Water's Edge. Our website URL is cfr.org. And he also tweets. Jim, your handle is?
@ James M. Lindsay.
Great. So I encourage you all to sign up for his tweets and follow his blog. So thank you, Jim, again for today. Our next call will be on Thursday, October 25th at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. Thomas Boloky, CFR's Senior Fellow for Global Health, Economics and Development, will talk about non-communicable diseases in the developing world. And you can see the fall lineup for the academic conference call series at CFR.org educators. So thank you again for today and to you, Jim.
Oh, thank you very much, Irina, and thank you everybody who turned out on the phone call. Have a great week.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.